33. Now, I was advised by the clerk that one side wished to use some boards here for oral argument. I might remind you we are not a trial court, but it's my understanding that the side that's offering the exhibits has shown them to the other side, that there's no objection, and also all of these were in the record, so we're not going outside the record, so it's something that we can look at, and it's merely to, we're not adding anything additional to the record. Am I correct?
That's correct from our point of view, Your Honor, and we're the ones that are offering this, Jerry Hyatt.
And since we don't know who that is, the voice picks it up.
Jerry Hyatt for Metzler.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Now, this we have cross appeals here. So, essentially, but it's all related to the same situation. So, my guess we've got, so I'm sort of thinking that means each of you have rebuttal to the other person's appeal, but you still only have 15 minutes each. And I see many people sitting here, and I want to dispel everyone of the thought that you each have 15 minutes sitting here. You have 15 minutes per side, and that includes your appeal, your cross appeal, your rebuttal, and however you want to divide the argument up. So I am, since no one is approaching the podium, counsel for Paul Stevens going to approach the podium to start? Okay. All right, I don't want to start the clock until we just sort of clarify. Does everyone understand this?
May I just ask a question, Your Honor, about this Jerry
Hyatt? I hope I know the answer.
Yeah, Jerry Hyatt again for Metzler. So I would assume when Mr. Schurz is finished speaking, I could present our opposition and reserve a couple of minutes for rebuttal, that he would get up again and rebut me if he wishes, and that I would have the last up. Is that how it would work?
Well, basically, but if we feel like we have additional questions, if depending on how it presents itself, I'm never going to deny anyone on my panel the opportunity to ask a question before they go.
Just
the last say here, you know, it's not we're not trying to make it tricky that way, and I think we've moved beyond the point that whoever has the last say wins. So we generally go to the law and the merits of the case.
You'll have to have time left.
Sorry?
If you want to get up again, you'll have to have time left.
Yes, we'll reserve a couple of minutes.
Exactly.
All right. Yeah, thank you. All right.
And as always, people get possessive about their time, but I always remind them, really, the time belongs to the court. And we take it's to answer our questions. And so as long as we have questions, you get to speak. But otherwise, on your own time, if we use all your time, then all your time is gone.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Your Honors. James Schurz on behalf of Paul Stevens and Ellie Stevens. And with the court's permission, we would ask to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you.
May it please the court, the Stevens appeal here to vacate the underlying arbitration award is premised on two propositions. The first is the plain language of a single specially negotiated provision in a detailed construction contract, what's referred to in the briefs as Article 7.1.3.1. And so that we have that language in mind as we continue our discussion, that section provides, in relevant part, no course of conduct or dealings between the parties shall be the basis of any claim to an increase in any amounts due under the contract. Excerpt of Record 143. It is our position that this language divests the arbitrator of jurisdiction to determine a claim for an increase in the contract sum or any amounts owed under the contracts. The second major premise on which the Stevens appeal is grounded is that the face of the award explicitly and repeatedly demonstrates that the sole basis for this arbitrator's finding with respect to this claim was the course of conduct and dealing of the parties.
Well, let me ask you this, just to kind of frame that issue. we're looking at it, you know, we've talked a lot about standard of review. Here we have a little bit of a double lens, don't we? I mean, first the district court has to look at the arbitration agreement and is looking at it to determine whether it's plausible, correct? And then we're reviewing the district court under another standard of review. Is that correct?
This court looks at the district court's analysis de novo. And so it engages directly with the arbitrator's ruling on its own terms. And that standard was articulated by Judge Burrison in Johnson versus Wells Fargo just last year. The point Your Honor raises, though, is the question is how does the court and this court address the underlying issue of the agreement itself? And it is our position, as detailed in our brief, that the court reviews the agreement de novo. It must determine that the award is grounded in the agreement of the parties and the issues they present for resolution, as this court said in Coast Trading.
And do you agree that the parties, through their course of conduct, could waive Article 7.1.3.1?
No, Your Honor, they did not.
No, not whether they did or they didn't. Do you agree that that the parties could, through their course of conduct? You're saying they didn't here, but could parties?
Not through one of the three equitable theories that is the basis of 7.1.3.1. So Your Honor raises the question, is this a non-waivable provision? Even faced with the language that pertains to all of the contract provisions, that they may not be waived. And the answer to that question is that these parties expressly agreed in 7.1.3.1 that the arbitrator would not have the authority to determine whether the parties had, by virtue of one of three equitable bases, waived or given up the detailed cost protection standards that are part of this contract.
I don't understand that. I mean, once you have this provision, one of the parties can't, and one of the parties goes out and says, I want this done in addition, and I want this done in addition, and the contractor does it, that the contractor can't get paid because of this provision.
The contractor can seek reimbursement or an increase in the contract sum. It just can't seek it under one of the three provisions, the three equitable theories that Article 7.1.3.1 precludes. So
what would it use?
It could argue that the architect approved it. There are specific provisions
This doesn't talk about architect approved it. It says no course of conduct or dealings nor expressed shall be the basis.
Exactly, Your Honor. And my point is,
are you suggesting they bring an unjust enrichment action?
No, they can't.
Oh, they can't.
Well, that's why I'm trying to keep, it seems to me, I guess I'm trying to figure out.
So what is the contractor's remedy here, Your Honor? Is they can seek to establish that a change order was not required. And under the AIA documents, there are specific provisions and instances where a change order is not required.
Okay,
didn't argue that.
But let's just sort of get back a little. Don't you have to prevail, show that the arbitrator's interpretation of Article 7.1.3.1 was implausible?
I have to establish that
we would interpret it that way or not. You have to show it was implausible, don't you?
I have to show that he overrode an express term of the contract under the standard that this court articulated 2 years ago in Pullmaster. An express term of the contract may not be overridden by the arbitrator. And the decisions of this court that I would refer Your Honors to, and you've been kind in asking, what's your best case in this circuit? And I would direct the court to two decisions specifically. One is the Pullmaster decision by Judge Wallace with Judge Hugg, in which they decided 2 years ago that the language that provided that the disputes shall be brought at the defendant's sites precluded the arbitrator from making a determination as to whether or not those claims could be adjudicated as part of counsel.
I read Judge Wallace's decision in Pullmaster, and it seems to me that is not controlling, because there was a specific provision contained conditions which specifically related to arbitration. In other words, it wasn't a broad contract like this. There were specific provisions relating to arbitration there.
Just, Your Honor, as we would submit, so does 7.1.3.1. When the parties...
Well, that, I understand what that says, but I also read the contract, and I don't see anything here that doesn't go to arbitration. 4.6.1 says any claim arising out of or relating to the contract, except claims relating to some which aren't even applicable here, shall be subject to arbitration.
That's correct.
Any claim. That isn't what happened in Polymaster. There was never language like that in there.
Well, Your Honor, what Polymaster stood for the proposition is that claims shall be brought, disputes shall be brought at the defendant's site. Dispute, as it was framed within the context of that technology agreement, was broadly framed. It included the same arising out of or relating to language that we see here. The point is that just as in this case, the AIA documents have an express carve-out for four different types of claims that are not subject to arbitration. What the parties accomplished in 7.1.3.1 was to augment, to add, those provisions that would specifically not be subject to arbitration, and specifically the three equitable theories that are identified and enumerated in that provision.
Well, that would suggest that what I'm trying to do, what you want me to do, is interpret the contract to suggest that 7.1.3.1 gives an exception to 4.6.1. And if I go there, I'm interpreting the contract, and I don't think that's the court's prerogative.
Thank you, Your Honor. We are not.
I mean, I'm trying to read right through what you're saying in order to get there. Because if I go where you want me to go, I have to say that this is an exception to 4.6. And in order for me to do that, I've got to interpret the contract. And in order to do that, the arbitrator has the power to do that. The court does not.
Your Honor, what we would ask you to do is not to interpret the contract, but rather to enforce the contract according to its terms. As this court has stated on a number of occasions, and as it stated most recently in the Polymaster decision, that it would not override or allow the arbitrator to override an express term of the contract. The consequence, Your Honor, of a provision like this, if we assume that only the arbitrator can construe 7.1.3.1, is that we've read it out of the contract completely. It has no force in effect, because now we've allowed the defense, in effect, to come in, the defense that was offered by the contractor that the parties, through their course of conduct and dealing, intended to waive the detailed cost protection procedures and contract administration procedures that they agreed to. The contract provisions, we would urge the court to recall and remember that these were specially negotiated. These are not boilerplate provisions. These parties, represented by counsel, entered into supplementary conditions, and under the Brinderson...
I'm not sure what you think that... It seems to me that the arbitrator had the jurisdiction to determine how the parties intended to calculate the contract sum. But so if that's not the case, then what was the scope of the arbitrator's jurisdiction?
The arbitrator was allowed, and it was within the scope of the arbitrator's authority to determine the contract sum. We don't contest that. It was properly, the audit claim, the overbilling claim that the Stevens brought as part of this arbitration was properly within the scope of the arbitration. What was not a part of that was the defense that was offered by the contractor, namely that all of those change order procedures, those detailed change order procedures that the arbitrator realized were there for the Stevens, that they could be cast aside or abandoned, to use the language of the arbitrator, in light of the party's course of conduct and dealing. That rationale was specifically precluded by Article Section 7.1.3.
Are you suggesting that the arbitrator has no authority to find an ambiguity in the contract?
The arbitrator has indeed the authority and the province to determine that there is an
ambiguity. Isn't that exactly what the arbitrator did here?
No, Your Honor. The arbitrator did not find there was any ambiguity with respect to 7.1.3.1 or the change order procedures, none whatsoever. What he did, at the invitation of the contractor, was citing the Hokama decision, the Hawaiian law, to say that the intent of the parties, the course of conduct in the and of dealing within the parties, creates doubt and ambiguity as to its meaning. The district court, Judge Kaye, found that that was error. The failure of the district court below was in properly identifying the error. He denominated it a legal error when it was in fact a jurisdictional error. In this case,
oh, for heaven's sake, if the parties don't pay any attention to the words of the contract and act contrary to it, doesn't the arbitrator have the right to look to that and say that they didn't pay any attention to this, so they abandoned this provision?
In this case, Your Honor, not with respect to these three equitable theories as it relates to an increase in the contract sum. And the rationale, Your Honor, is that this contract was in effect a risk allocation exercise, as all contracts are. And what the parties were saying was, in taking the lessons of this court's reasoning in Todd Shipyards, which was, if there's a change order procedure and the parties agree to it, it can be waived. These parties, with full knowledge of the limitations of Todd Shipyard, said, well, we're going to insulate ourselves from that.
Do you want to reserve for rebuttal? You're at 2 minutes.
I do.
Okay, thank you.
Dave, you come in.
All right, before I start the clock, are you the only one that's going to be talking on this side?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yeah,
thank you.
I have a lot of briefcases there.
Mr. Colley Feldman, Bruce Voss, and David Major all helped with the arbitration, Your Honor.
All right. Well, I just want to make sure that
absolutely
you don't cut it. If there's someone else that's going to talk, that we allocate the time. All right. We can start the clock then. Please state your appearance and your name for the record.
Jerry Hyatt for the Metzler Contracting Company. With me is Kelly Feldman, Bruce Voss, and David Majors. Thank you, Your Honors, for your guidance before the argument. I'm going to try to focus on what I think are the key points from my client's perspective. First of all, essentially what's happening here is that there's been a request by the Stevens to have a do-over of a six-week arbitration that resolved about $21 million in swing on a luxury home on the Kohala Coast. This process has consumed, I think, more than 5 years at this point, and I was at the beginning of it. The courts correctly focused on what the arbitrator had to do. First, he had to determine his own jurisdiction.
Is his voice going to pick up if he steps away from the microphone? So you need to stay around the microphone.
Okay.
That's why these exhibits aren't always a great idea.
Well, and I'm glad to let you do it, and I think it's a wonderful thing, but you must know that these notes we have in front of us have these same similar things here.
I understand.
All right.
It's just to make it
clear. I mean, juries like this stuff, but we're not jury. I'm not nearly, I mean, that's why they call me judge. There's no justice in the Ninth Circuit. Let's go forward.
All right. But we start with what was submitted, and I'll just use them then quickly. We start with what was submitted, and
I
as
like
you,
these things. So just,
okay.
Just so you don't think we all agree on everything.
Thanks, Judge Schroeder. You started with this point, Judge, and it was that there's a broad arbitration clause here under which every claim and any claim was submitted, and it included interpretation of the contract terms. And I think the arbitrator had to start there, too.
Well, let me just ask you to tell me, I asked Stevens counsel, Mr. Schertz, what's our standard of review here? What does he have to show to prevail?
You correctly stated it. I mean, there has to be no... Your review of Judge Kaye's decision is de novo, but his review of the arbitrator's decision was no plausible basis for the award. No plausible basis for the award. And Mr. Schurz avoided answering that question. And so that's the standard that's appropriate. So if we go back to this.
So we're really reviewing the same thing he reviewed.
Exactly.
On a no plausible basis.
That's right. There has to be no rational basis. And, in fact, I excerpted that.
Well, that's what I wanted to make sure.
Under power agent, you have to find that the arbitrator's decision was completely irrational or constituted a manifest disregard of the law.
How do you respond to Stephen's argument that the arbitrator exceeded his authority by increasing the amount due under the preliminary budget based on the party's course of conduct?
I was about to focus on exactly that. So he had to construe these terms. He goes to 5.1.1, and this says the contract sum is the cost of the work plus the contractor's fee. Okay? So he looks at that. And then he listens to the Stevens argument that 7.1.3.1, there can't be a change in the contract sum unless there's a change order. So he's got to construe those two provisions together. Okay? Then the Stevens argue, well, the contract sum, which is referred to here, is actually this term in 6.5 because it refers to a preliminary budget, including an itemized schedule of values, which represents the contractor's best estimate of the contract sum. So they start there, and they say that $10 million figure is, in fact, the contract sum. It's not, because a preliminary budget, which represents a best estimate, a current best estimate, is not what's defined as the contract sum. The contract sum is the cost of the work plus the fee. So where do they get this? Well, what does he do next? What he does next...
Don't talk.
Sorry.
Move it.
What he does next in solving this...
You got your best helping you make this good.
Thanks. His best task, then, is to go to 5.2.1 and say, how do I find out whether it's a contract sum? Is it going to change or not? So he goes to 5.2.1, and he notes the two places there where it says there's a not-to-exceed number, a place for it in the contract, because this is an AIA form built, you know, like a bus to haul any number of people, any kind of a job. You just fill in the right blanks. Well, it was not a guaranteed max job. So these blanks were not filled in. There was no maximum price for the contract. So where did this myth of the preliminary budget equaling the contract sum arise in the case? It arose in this instruction from Mr. Anderson to his expert, saying the total construction cost should have been $10 million, which was his preliminary budget. Review it so we can discuss how this might be incorporated in your analysis. So we had a fungible expert who misconstrued the contract at the direction of counsel to create a myth about a contract sum, and that's the entire basis of the audit claim. So what did Mr. Sheehan do? He had to construe it. And under Hawaii law, though he probably misstated about where he should go first, he got it right here in his award, when he said, if there's any doubt or controversy as to the meaning of language embodying a contractual bargain, extrinsic evidence may be considered. He cited the correct case. He cited the correct standard. He construed those provisions together, and he came up with the view that the contract sum was the cost of the work plus a fee.
So essentially, though, you're in a way, you're arguing that the arbitrator didn't commit any legal or clear error or something along those lines, but really we have to look at it to determine plausibility.
Seems plausible to me, but that's exactly correct, Your Honor.
But you're also, okay.
That's exactly correct. And he made a careful analysis of all those terms and in a long award, and he came to a very, very plausible explanation, which the court found very plausible. And in doing that, bearing in mind that you're not a jury, he had all of these admissions before he came to that conclusion. He had the admission from Colin Johns, who was the expert who came up with this contract sum theory, the bogus one, that there was a plain definition of contract sum in the contract. He had the admission, again, same gentleman, under the terms of the contract, he was supposed to be reimbursed for the cost of the work plus his fee. He had the admission from Ellie Stevens that she knew it was a cost-plus job. Go ahead.
Right. Well, but looking at it slightly differently, the other side's position is, what is the work?
What is the work, exactly?
And that the work had to be what was originally defined, unless it was written in writing that it was expanded, and that didn't happen. So therefore, the work is the original. What the origin was originally contemplated.
So something which perhaps isn't clear is that there were no complete plans at the time the preliminary budget was done. There was no definition supplied for what the work would be. And that's why that term, preliminary budget based on a best estimate, is so important. And why the other term, contract sum is the cost of the work, is also so important. Because on a cost-plus job, when there's not a guaranteed max, you basically pay as the invoices come in, which she did, and which she admits having done here. Okay. She admits to this agreement with Mr. Metzler that she waived the change order process, and she didn't want anything other than for him to keep the records of the job, which she then paid without objection all the way up to $17 million. And it made it so difficult then for her to take the position that she didn't know. The architect also, Mr. Dale, there was no upper limit to the construction job here. I mean, this house was built with things being installed, ripped out, put back in.
If I get the flavor of this, there were instructions being given to the contractor to change the work.
Incredibly large instructions, yes. Yes. And again, she admitted that there was no budget for the job.
And so the arbitrator's finding was, in effect, that because you're...
It had been abandoned.
That procedure had been... That requirement in the contract procedure was not followed, and that requirement had been abandoned.
Well, with one clarification, I think it's very important for a legal analysis of our case, Your Honor, and that's this. If you accept the definitions of the contract that I just walked through, the cost of this work, the price of this job was the cost of the work plus a fee, there was no need for change orders because it was a cost plus job. In a guaranteed price contract, guaranteed maximum, yeah, you would have a number which you could only change by a change order. But here, the change order process would have just been a budget sort of tracking tool. And by
No,
checking
but that's
off.
Not necessarily yeah. true, because a change order doesn't just cover the cost. The change order covers what has to be done. Mm. So if your dispute were over whether it called for granite or marble, you would need
fair enough.
You would want to have a written change order.
Fair enough. But in this case, basically, it was abandoned. There was only two or three at the beginning, and it was abandoned. So there were one or two more points I was going to make, and that is, at footnote one of their brief, they abandoned the argument which they had made below that there was no jurisdiction on the part of the arbitrator to hear these claims because they hadn't been submitted first to the architect. And there's an admission here that none of the claims were submitted to the architect, including the one which is the subject of this appeal, the audit claim, a multimillion-dollar claim. So they're taking the position in front of this court that the arbitrator had no jurisdiction on some issues, but they've sort of slyly taken out of the argument the fact that he would have had no jurisdiction on their entire audit claim, which is the subject of this appeal, because it was never first submitted to the architect. So, you know, another argument which we have made is simply that under Mayfair, if they've abandoned this whole submission process, then it would be a moot issue anyway because you couldn't remand because the arbitrator wouldn't have jurisdiction because nothing was ever submitted to the architect. And I think that's the argument they were trying to avoid.
All right. Then you have your other issue, and I wonder where in the record do you properly preserve the argument that the party's course of conduct below showed a clear intent to use the Hawaiian rules of arbitral procedure. And even if the argument is not waived, how do you rebut the default presumption that the FAA, not state law, supplies the rules for arbitration?
Thanks, Ron. I was about to go to that. First,
if you want to reserve any time, you better do it quickly.
Okay, well, I'm going to reserve a minute and a half, if I can. And in the remaining minute that I've got here, I'll talk about, try to answer your question. First of all, up until the argument in front of the U.S. District Court Judge Kaye, both sides were claiming attorney's fees under 658.25, the Hawaii Arbitration Act, which has a really wonderful policy. It is that if you fight about an award, prevailing party gets fees. So if, you know, it's fine, you can make any agreement you want to prior to that time, but if you fight about an award, prevailing party gets fees. And that's great policy, and it's a policy of the state of Hawaii. At the beginning of that argument, Mr. Schurz was asking for fees. Judge Kaye clarified that the only basis for it was under Hawaii law. We were also asking for fees from the point of the arbitration award onwards, and we're asking for them here. That's the first time. I mean, his decision was the first time that we knew that fees would not be awarded. Through the state of, to the point of that argument, okay, they were asking for them. Mr. Schurz was asking for them. So we preserved because we asked for them below, and they asked for them below, and we're asking for them now. The clear course of conduct by the Stevens in this case was repeatedly throughout the arbitration, leading up to the motion to dismiss, they ask for fees. All that's required under George Day and your other cases is a clear course of conduct showing the adoption of the state rule under the FAA. That's here. You can use this case for something more than the disposition of a garden variety arbitration decision. You can use this case to tell the next litigant, if you fight about an arbitration award and the state statute provides for a prevailing party attorney's fees thing, you're at risk. And that would be a useful thing for the panel to do. I'll reserve.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I could pick up on a couple of points, and first with respect to a comment, Judge Schroeder, with respect to the nature of the effect of this the course of conduct and dealing. In response, you heard from the Contractors Council that, in fact, there were no change orders that were even necessary in this contract. That construction requires you not only to set aside 7.1.3.1, but to also set aside all of Article 7 and to set aside all of Article 6.5. It requires you to find that the arbitrator got it wrong when he said that the parties agreed to detailed contract administration procedures that included cost protection measures. What Mr. Hyatt is urging you to do is adopt a version of the contract that no one ascribes to. And with respect to the nature of the inquiry that is incumbent upon this court, we would ask again, in looking at the Polemaster decision, in looking at the Coast Trading, that the proper source of analysis is to ask whether there was an express term that limited the arbitrability, limited the jurisdiction of the arbitrator with respect to certain claims. And we submit that that is the only construction that is afforded under 7.1.3.1, that it is not ambiguous in any way, that the absence of any language with respect to arbitrability is of no consequence here, because these parties intended to foreclose the very arguments that you've now been provided with. Evidence that was presented at the hearing, which the Stevens objected to at the time in the context of a motion to eliminate, objected to in the form of a summary disposition, and argued that the arbitrator should not hear it because he was precluded from hearing it under this provision. Addressing very quickly, if I may, the choice of law question, I'd refer the panel to our petition to vacate. You will see at the petition to vacate, ER 44 to 66, we did not request attorney's fees. What you heard from Mr. Hyatt was just wrong. There was at no time any indication that the Stevens sought attorney's fees in the context of this vacature or confirmation proceedings.
So when is the first time attorney's fees were sought?
In the underlying arbitration before the arbitrator. It had nothing to do with the proceedings that were filed in the District Court of Hawaii. And under Johnson versus Gruma, this court's recent decision, it is that which is incumbent upon this court to look to. What was the party's intent in terms of adopting the procedural rules for confirmation and vacature of the proceeding. And as you'll see in Judge Kaye's analysis below, there's no indication, there's no evidence that these parties, through any of their agreements, sought to invoke the procedural rules of Hawaii with respect to the confirmation and vacature proceedings, and that throughout the Stevens have argued for application of federal law. If there are no further questions,
thank you.
We will submit. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, I gave the appellant, respondent, or whatever, both. I gave the Stevens side a minute and a half over, so you can add a minute and a half to just to show how generous I am.
You're very kind, Your Honor. So let me just start with the first point, and that is, or the last point that Mr. Schurz raised, because he took the position that he was not claiming attorney's fees for Judge Kaye. And I very respectfully but vigorously disagree. It's in the transcript. Judge Kaye asked him if he was claiming attorney's fees. He said yes. And then he had a colloquy with him about upon what basis. And Judge Kaye said it's only under Hawaii law that they're available because they're not available under the FAA. So I just turn you to the record. The second point I wanted to make is
you have a spot at the record. We could look at that. I hate to use your time to do that, but okay, just go forward while your mad briefers are helping you out.
I hope my colleague can find it, but it's there. And it's the transcript is in, I think, the second volume of one of the records. The other underlying argument that Mr. Schurz has made is that 7.1.3.1 is somehow jurisdictional. And I just suggest to you that if that clause is jurisdictional, under this closely negotiated contract, they could have put it in the right place to deal with the arbitration clause in the any claim provision, but they did not. The representation that this was closely negotiated or a carve-out is untrue. There hasn't been a single cite to the record by the Stevens showing that it was closely negotiated or that it was taken with a view of the Todd Shipyards case. So it is at 1 SER.
Judge K and counsel,
yeah,
is where?
1 SER 34. The court, you both asked for attorney's fees. Mr. Schurz, in our request, yes. Goes on from there.
All right. Your time is basically expired, so.
Thank you for your time and attention.
All right.
And I also want to just say thank you very much for coming out to see us at the beginning. That was, showed a lot of aloha.
Our pleasure. We enjoy meeting counsel.
And we assure you that Judge Schroeder would have been there if she hadn't had that very important call. And she'd have been the best one to shake hands with. She's got the most gray hair and ready. She'll be here tomorrow.
Be back tomorrow. All right. Thank you, everyone, today for your argument. This matter will stand submitted. We're in recess tomorrow till 9 o'clock.